Good morning. Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Thursday, the 9th of February. It's now 8:34 a.m. Senator French, Senator Guest, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seacon, Senator Terry will join us shortly. We're going to start with a hearing this morning on Senate Bill 237. And let's see who we have from the state that would like to work with us on 237. Susan, did you want to grace us with your presence? And Chris, maybe? Looks like two representatives from the state, from the... Very interesting, Chris, very interesting address by the Chief Justice yesterday. You got to stand and be recognized. As, so, got that little moment in the spotlight there. Congratulations. And you guys know the drill. Whoever would like to start out this morning?
Go ahead. Thank you. For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I think the only thing I have to add from our discussion yesterday, I think the two remaining issues were a letter of intent, which I think Brian is handing out, drafted up a letter of intent for your consideration that incorporates the findings and intent that were in the bill, and then a few additional comments that came out of, I think, testimony. So I propose that you take a look at that and see if you'd like to forward that with the bill. And then I believe the only other open issue was an additional Palmer judge, which of course the Department of Law supports, and I think Mr. Christensen may have some information on whether the court system could accommodate a second Palmer judge, which was discussed.
Senator Huggins, did you questions on that?
Well, yeah, Chris, if you could just, you know, kind of elaborate as far as, you know, if you would refresh your memory on the demand, number two, what the impact would be both in facility and capability.
For the record, Chris Christensen, Deputy Administrative Director, Alaska Court System. As I pointed out yesterday, Palmer has the highest per judge caseload for their of any court in the state for the entire caseload, Superior and District Court. We look specifically at the Superior Court. It has by far the highest caseload per Superior Court judge. If we were to add one new Superior Court judge, they would still have by far the highest Superior Court caseload. The problem, of course, is that the Valley is the one part of the state that is still experiencing dramatic growth. Every place else has slowed down in the last 5 or 6 years. Since 1990, the Valley has been growing at an average rate of about 4.5% a year, which is three times the rate of Anchorage or the rest of the state. If we were to add two Superior Court judges in Palmer, Palmer would no longer have the very highest per judge case rate in the state. They would be down to about number two or number three. They would probably be back to the highest within 5 years. They also have a pretty substantial backlog to overcome. Right now, they are more delayed in hearing cases than any other place. Now, the one problem we, of course, would have is space. And as you know, last year in the capital budget, we received the money, most of the money we needed to add two new courtrooms. I did check yesterday, and we determined that if we did get two new judges rather than one, we would be able to accommodate that extra judge. What we would probably have to do is continue having night court, which we've been doing now for about 2 years. That may be a good thing because night court, while it started as an administrative convenience for us to give us the space to bring a judge in from Anchorage, the community has actually welcomed it with open arms. People really seem to enjoy being able to go fight their traffic tickets or hear their small claims cases after work.
Right. So. Chris, you know, I was having breakfast with some emergency services people today, and I was impressed upon them how there were some people in this building I admired it because they recognized that there were demands across the state, different geographical regions, and in some cases didn't always say me too. And what I want to make sure is that in my talking to you about Palmer, that this isn't something that's making Palmer special. It's a demand that's there, and would just make it really get it back in with a within a normal bubble. It's reasonable and is not at the expense of another community that we would have a bulge out the other side of a symptom-wise. It would be denying them a judge. So do you think it's reasonable that this, if we carried forward with a recommendation of, binding for two judges for the Palmer area?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I not only think it's reasonable, I quite honestly think over the last 10 years, the court system has been unreasonable in its requests to the legislature for new judges.
Yeah.
We've always had this, sort of had an almost obsessive frugality over the last decade and a half. We have gone out of our way not to ask for high-ticket positions that we need. The last time Palmer got a new Superior Court judge was 1996. They were the number one court in the state, and rather than ask the legislature to create it and fund it, we transferred an existing Superior Court judge from Valdez because we decided the Valdez caseload had fallen, and 10 years later I still hear complaints from Valdez that they don't have their judge.
Yeah.
So this is why you've had the prosecutor come in this year and say, hey, something's wrong with the courts, we really need more judges in these locations. Our effort to live within our means has reached the point where it's affecting other agencies.
Right.
So two judges for Palmer is, I wouldn't say it even solves the problem, but it goes a long way towards addressing it.
Right. Yeah, you know, you mentioned the Chief Justice yesterday. Some of us had breakfast with the Chief Justice and some of the other justices. And the Chief Justice mentioned how once upon a time in his life that he used to commute out to Palmer to be a supplemental judge out there to assist in the caseload. But thank you very much.
Other questions this morning? Senator Gass.
Mr. Chair, do we need to move the letter of intent? Or do
yeah.
we need to do that
Let's go ahead and go back to the letter of intent, and it does need to be moved as a committee letter of intent.
Mr. Chair, I move that the February 9th letter of intent, Senate Judiciary, be adopted.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we'll do that. Next order of business then would be to entertain a we did already, as Bennett Amendment number one, drop the intent and language and the findings.
Yes.
And we did as Amendment number two, Anchorage 2, Palmer 1, Kenai 1, Fairbanks 1. Senator Huggins, the chair would entertain a movement
Mr. Chair,
we want to withdraw amendment number two. We want to change it to two. So
just want to go to two. We can amend the amendment.
We already passed the
amendment. Amendment's passed. I think you just want to make another amendment.
Want to make another amendment. Amendment number three, that we amend the amended bill to include two judges at Palmer.
Right.
Okay.
What's that?
Two things. When we amended for Fairbanks yesterday, it's in a different judicial district, so I think we just want
a number. Yeah.
We want another amendment. And the other thing that I just recognize is in the letter of intent, it doesn't have the B section of Section 1 that lays out the Anchorage 2 Palmer, or am I?
I don't think it, it didn't have the numbers.
So I guess the question to the administration and the committee is, do we need to put the intent of the legislature that the four additional Superior Court judges, et cetera, do we need to keep either put that in the letter of intent or keep it in the bill? Or is it purposely left out?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, the very last paragraph of the letter of intent indicates what the legislature's intent for these new judges in this bill is, because I wasn't sure how many judges ultimately would be added by this bill. I intentionally left out the specific number, and recognizing that even in finance, potentially the number could change. I guess my recommendation would be simply whatever number are added, you're adding because of these criminal caseload, and I don't know that the specific number is necessary for the letter of intent.
Okay.
I think I think what Gretchen is saying, or Senator Guest is saying here, is very interesting in that we're, by adding these six positions, we're trusting that they'll be assigned to the judicial districts and locations that we've discussed, rather than putting them in the act itself, because Senator Guest is correct. Paragraph B on line 7, page 2, is part of the letter of the intent and findings. And it's not part of the bill. So what we actually did yesterday was drop something and then amend something that we dropped. So we do have to do some corrective work here. I think you've picked that up, and you're right, Senator Guest. Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we can address the issue in section, what is now section 2 of the bill, mm-hmm. which lays out the number of judges assigned to each judicial district. Right. As mm-hmm. long as we make our amendment conform to the will of the committee, which is that we add, you know, a certain number to the third judicial district, a certain number to the fourth judicial district,
right.
I don't see how we can come out too far wrong.
Yeah.
Just as long as the Anchorage doesn't steal Palmer two new judges.
I can't imagine that happening, Mr. Chairman.
but it's specific mentions of geographical locale Palmer.
Well, it's
right.
In the intent.
It's only by judicial district is right. how the what
it
I
is
see
by
the,
judicial district okay. in the bill, yes. Yeah. And we're trusting that
we've got a yeah. It's hard for me to imagine somewhere.
Right.
You know.
Chris.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, normally when these bills have been drafted over the years, the drafter puts the locations in the title, but in the actual language of the bill itself, they just list the judicial district. And I think in this case, I think everybody is in agreement where the real problems are and where these judges need to be placed. And, you know, 15 or 20 years from now, you may have a situation that arises, for example, where we transferred a Valdez judge who had been there for many, many decades because the population there had declined. But I think for right now and for the certainly the right. foreseeable future, this is where these judges have to be, because let's, that's where the work is.
Let's step down through this. First amendment that I would entertain this morning is an amendment to change the title, an act increasing the number of Superior Court judges designated for the third and fourth judicial districts to provide additional Superior Court judges at Anchorage, Palmer, Kenai, and Fairbanks, and providing for an effective date. That's the first amendment that I think we need to have.
It's amendment number three.
Number three.
So moved.
Amendment number three has been moved by Senator Guest so that the title would read, an act increasing the number of Superior Court judges designated for the third and fourth judicial districts to provide additional Superior Court judges at Anchorage, Palmer, Kenai, and Fairbanks, and providing for an effective date. Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number three is adopted. Amendment number four should be, I believe, number of judges. We would amend the section two to read, number of judges, the Superior Court consists of 40 mm-hmm. judges, five of whom shall be judges in the first judicial district, three of whom shall be judges in the second district, 25 of whom shall be, no, 26 of whom.
24.
24.
Oh, 24 of whom shall be judges in the third judicial district.
And eight of
and
whom.
Eight.
And eight of whom shall be judges in the fourth judicial district.
Yeah.
That would be amendment number four. Is someone?
I'll move that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator French has moved amendment number four, which will then read, number of judges, the Superior Court consists of 40 judges, five of whom shall be judges in the first judicial district, three of whom shall be judges in the second judicial district, 24 of whom shall be judges in the third judicial district, and eight of whom shall be judges in the fourth judicial district. And then the rest of say it's the same. Is there objection? Hearing none. We have adopted the letter of intent. We have had two amendments that we talked about today. Does anyone see any further need for amending the bill? I don't think so.
I can just anticipate that there'll be an updated fiscal note to accompany the bill on the finance.
Right. We'll ask that the court update the fiscal note to attach it downstream before it gets to the Finance Committee. Is there further discussion on the bill?
I have a motion, Mr. Chair.
Ready for a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 237 as amended with the attached letter of intent and the attached fiscal notes, which will be updated before they go to Finance.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is advanced to the next committee of referral. Thank you very much for your time. Short recess. Thanks, Chris. Call the meeting back to order. Senator Guest.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In front of you is SB 10 again, no new versions. I did, at the request of the committee, try to draw up a matrix yesterday that reflects the different situations that we discussed and who would be liable for what amounts, and I'm hoping that clarifies what we were discussing yesterday. The issue before us seems to still be, do we hold the state liable for children either in their custody or their care, and what does that look like or not? The original bill did not have the state liable. That was current law. This committee decided to hold the state liable, and we've then been having a discussion about where that line should be, if there should be a line. I'm such a strong believer in the committee process. It really is a policy call, and since the committee decided to hold states liable in the first place, you know, I looked to the committee on their opinion about how we should move forward with state liability and any other issues with the bill.
Senator French.
Question for anyone who can answer it, and that is, I'm looking at Amendment 0 or 0.2 in the middle of the page. State is liable when the state has custody and parental rights are terminated. I know we talked a lot about numbers yesterday, but is that number 2,500? Is that what we think it is?
Go ahead. Put it up for the record, for us.
For the record, my name is Tony Newman. I'm a program officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. And through the chair, yes, we did a little bit more work on numbers of kids in custody, and we came up with a closer estimate as of today of around 2,300 kids in state's custody.
And whose parental rights have been terminated?
Mm-hmm.
And
through the chair, that number would be closer to 200 some kids.
200. 200. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Huggins.
From a practical standpoint, based on the conversation we've had in the school district's $100,000 deductible, and do they go after to collect the money, is there a potential that the state may be the only payee?
Payer.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Huggins, it would not be the way, it is not the intent, nor do I think the bill is written that way. Because the juvenile would still be on the hook for that first $5,000, and they would still be on the hook for the rest. It might be the quickest one,
right,
along with parents, might be the quickest one for the $15,000. It's why in previous legislation there has been parental liability, I think, on trying to balance restitution with accountability. So it may be the quickest amount of money. It won't be the only amount of money.
Right. Okay. That's the first part, Mr. Chair. The second one is the attractiveness to me of the state having a liability factor is that hopefully it creates a due diligence within the workforce that the supervisors say, look, you know, we're having some difficulties, and this is the way that we're going to deal with that from our perspective, so hopefully doing our job better when we're responsible for young people. If that happens, that's good enough for me. In that respect, now, I'm still a little frightened by the aspect of the state may be the one that really has a flow of money going out of its coffers, and everybody else is liable but never pays, sort of thing.
I understand. Ms. Carpenter, you look like you'd like to make a comment. Am I reading your body language correctly?
My only comment is, and maybe Mr. Thompson is better at it, I do think that the state is going to be the deep pocket on a lot of these if the state is responsible, because saying that the youth and his or her parents will be responsible down the line is making an assumption that they will get a permanent fund dividend, because that's the basic way that we get judgments collected from people who have either committed delinquent acts. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's a hope that you will get it in the future and the chance that you will, but the best chance will be the state pockets under these circumstances. And I think there are other people better than me to address that, but then maybe Mr. Thompson could. And probably Ms. Steinberg, who should be on the line, who does collections, yes, might be the best person to talk about success in collections from these people. So I just wanted to mention that to you.
Mr. Thompson?
For the record, Brett Thompson, Director of Division of Risk Management. I guess the policy call is, at what segment should the state be responsible? And if indeed we are, by one of these amendments or one of these parameters, strictly responsible, we will immediately pay. As I mentioned yesterday, we may be responsible for one of four children in the act, and we may be more targeted. That's, I guess, something to consider. The other comment I would make, perhaps, is to Senator Huggins that, in fact, custody for the state is legal custody, but not actual physical custody. So, and that's I think, what's attempted to be also weighed when you allocate between parents today.
Is there any, Brad, do we have any way that you could try to assess the risk in terms of dollars to the state based on these 2,300 kids that are out there? Some of them are so young that they're not going to be involved in vandalism. Some of them are in their teenagers. I'm not sure you have a demographic breakdown. Is there any way to assess this?
If I can, Mr. Chair, between last night and this morning, I went online and I went to the Insurance Information Institute, which is the data gathering for all homeowner or personal lines. And throughout each state, they have collected data as to how many homeowners actually procure insurance, how many renters buy insurance, the average cost in each state, and then the type of claim and the average cost per claim. The code for, or the classification for the vandalism and malicious mischief in the last 5 years has varied between 11% or 13% down to 6%. So I didn't average it out, but it's, say, 10% of all property damage claims to personal lines. That would be both homeowner and renter's policies. Homeowners, by the way, on average throughout the nation, there's 95% of homeowners have insurance. 64% of respondents living in rental properties had no insurance. And so, just to give you, I think yesterday there was the question as to how many did carry coverage. And then there's another article that they put out about arson being a leading cause and an increase in the cause. And children are responsible for almost half of the arson fires in the United States. Intentionally set fires have grown in the number of fires and the value of loss. And I'd be glad to provide this to the committee, but there's increasing dollars expended for structure and personal property damages. Juveniles under 18 years of age accounted for 42.7% of arson arrests in 2004. Arson is one of the lowest. It goes on with a lot of statistics, so I'd rather provide that.
Okay. It's pretty tough for us, though, to try to figure. We got 2,300 kids that are in state custody, so to speak. I understand Mr. Newman correctly. Of that 2,300, we could probably say the ones that are dangerous to vandalism and property damage are going to be in the preteen and teenage years. So of that 2,300, how many of them fall into that segment of the population? What's our universe here? Our universe goes from newborn to 19 years of age. Once they're 19, or is it 18 that they're no longer in that position?
It's 18 unless the court extends to 19.
You can't extend.
Can't extend to 19.
That doesn't happen that
often. Not very often. But normally we'd say the universe then would be until their 18th birthday. So we have 18 years of risk in the universe. And of that, what segment constitute these higher risk individuals? So that we'd say, okay, I mean, if we tried to say 5 to 10% of 2,300 kids, then we're saying a huge chunk of the higher risk kids are really high risk kids as far as damage is concerned, because a 3-year-old probably isn't going to do any vandalism damage. And I would imagine, but once they get into their pre-teenage, once they get into junior high age, they start having capabilities. And so they're, say, 13 to 18. There's a 5-year period where they're probably a higher risk. What percentage of the total universe of 2,300 children in state custody does that constitute? Do we have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, you correctly point out that there's a variety of factors at play here. Those kids, most kids in state's custody are OCS kids, who are typically younger than juvenile justice kids who are committing acts of vandalism. They're also, because they're in state custody, they're often in placements where they don't get the opportunity to commit a lot of vandalism, so that's another factor at play. I don't have a breakdown of the age distribution. I can get that for you of approximately how old the kids are who are in state's custody, if you'd like.
I'm not sure that we need to have it at this point if we don't have it available, but it just seems that we've significantly shrunk the universe of potential violators or vandalism perpetrators, so to speak. If we look at how that population of children in state custody is distributed, I would believe. So when we start looking at 10% of that universe, of the smaller universe, the risk significantly decreases, in my opinion. But we don't have, that's the hard part here, is we don't have hard numbers of how much vandalism has been committed by these kids in this universe. We're not sure of the actual size of the universe, but we do believe someone should be responsible and not just say, well, once a kid gets into state custody, nobody has any responsibility for their actions anymore. And so the property owner is left in limbo. And that's where I think I am. And so I kind of lean towards this, say, okay, when the state takes that child out of the house and places them somewhere, if the foster parent doesn't have any liability, well, does that mean that that kid now wanders in society without anything other than their personal liability, if we're holding parents responsible for some of the damage? And so I kind of get to the point where I'm trying to figure out what that risk is. I think it's something that I'm comfortable with at this point. I know this would have to go to Finance Committee from here, and maybe those are some of the questions that we need to be able to have to assess the size of the risk is, okay, what is that universe? How does it disperse in terms of demographic? Do that actuarial thing that all those risk assessors like to do. Mr. Thompson, I know you've participated in that a lot in your career, I'm sure. But that's a hard part for me. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you look at the matrix, I guess to be within my comfort zone is that I see it as if you have the authority over the child, you have some vested responsibility. And I guess one of the things that made me nervous the last time we were talking about it, here there were some instances where we were saying the biological parent was responsible financially, but in reality, authority-wise, we had them in another setting. Does this accurately reflect that is not the case as you look at the matrix? And the sponsor are the same. Am I making sense?
Senator Huggins.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. It would be the case in the first one on 0.3, if the state's not liable, regardless of if there's custody or care, and the juvenile has parents, their parents would be liable for that segment of the damage. So I think that's the case. If I heard you correct the last couple meetings, that you're uncomfortable with, the state's taken maybe custody, the parent doesn't have physical custody of their child, mm-hmm. The state's not liable, but then the parent's on the hook when the child runs away from foster care and does an act of vandalism. So I think
that's a tough one, in my estimation, that we're saying that financially the parent's liable, but they don't have any authority over the person. They can't control the person. It's beyond their capability, I think.
I believe, you know, we could, I thought one other permutation here, since you introduced me to a new word today, Senator French. Normally, words with more than two syllables confuse me. It appears to me that in the end, part of my concern is for the property owner. I'm not trying to let the kid off the hook. But we talk about the insurance companies being able they love to subrogate, find somebody else that's responsible, and go back and try to recoup their losses. And it seems to me that in some respects, we ought to allow the parent who has to come up with that extra $15,000 or the state to seek recovery from the juvenile. In the end, yes, Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chairman, yesterday I was able to provide information on the kind of damages that have been incurred by kids who are in state's custody. It indicated to me that the state is holding kids accountable when they're doing damages in state's custody. They are if they're not able to secure the restitution because or they don't, if it's a small level of restitution, they're able to get the kids to work off the damages they committed. They'll take the kids to court if they need to secure the restitution. I think the problem, the issue is we're sort of shifting the foundation under which kids are in custody. Right now, statute says that parents retain residual rights, one of which is support of the minor, which I believe would include when they commit acts of vandalism. So it's difficult to tell how that would change the situation, because we might be, I understand by codifying that there's liability by the state, we are opening up third-party claims which don't exist at this point. This is shifting the foundation under which we're working now, and the way we're working now, I'm not sure has indicated that there's a problem where kids aren't being held accountable. Seems to me we are holding kids accountable when they're committing damages in state's custody.
Senator Guest.
Thank you. A few comments about the discussion. I just want to clarify again, because I think sometimes at least this word continues to bother me, that the state will be the deep pocket. We are still talking about acts of vandalism that are over $25,000, and we're limiting the state's liability, just like the parent's liability, to 15. So if it's, up to from 5 to 20, so it's $15,000. So I just want to remind folks of that, because I think it's easy to, and I think it's a good concern to have. We have spent the last 3 years on this bill, and we have tried to get data from everywhere, and it's been very difficult in a lot of situations. But I will tell you some of the data and some observations that I've had, especially working with school districts that tend to have the larger cases that actually kids get caught. I mean, we have to remember that someone actually has to get caught for this to go into effect. One is that from the data that we could gather, and this isn't state's custody or not state's custody, but about 98-99% of the cases that we could find were all $5,000 or less. So it's a small percentage of them that are these large cases. They've been highlighted mainly in Anchorage situations. I also have to say that I've never heard from a school district, and we've been in touch with all the larger ones, that there's been an issue, well, that the kid was in state's custody, so we couldn't we couldn't get reimbursed. So I haven't either seen a case where the kids in state custody are out, you know, burning down schoolyards and people can't recover the cost. But we are seeing cases where, you know, kids are burning down schoolyards and the parents are saying you shouldn't have flammable schoolyards, and school districts are never recouping that cost, and it goes on the taxpayers. So it is kind of where that balance is. It is whether or not you want to hold the state in par with the parent or not. So those are some observations, at least from everything we've been going out and trying to deal with, mainly school districts and municipalities, who have seen these larger cases than the ones under 5,000. Thank you.
Ms. Carpinetti.
Through the chair, I would also say that it's, you know, we're focused now on state liability for damages, but this bill as a whole is a lot bigger. It affects all sorts of kids doing damages,
right,
and the ability of people to recover, and that's an important consideration too for victims. And I think the Office of Victims' Rights might have something to say about the other the aspects, and they're not so interested in the state liability as they are in the
right
victims' ability to recover. It is easy to get distracted by this particular issue because all the state's lawyers are here because they're concerned about it, but it's bigger than that.
Right now, we have Stacy Steinberg, Gail Voigtlander, and Diane Olson, all from law, are online. Are there any questions that any of you want to address to these ladies that are available for us for additional assistance at this point? Any pertinent issues that jumped out at any one of you three ladies? All right, well, we do. I would tell you my personal leaning is towards option number two, O.4.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Oh,
who do we have?
O.2 or O.4.
This is Stacy Steinberg. I'm the section chief for the collections and support section of the Department of Law.
Go ahead, Stacy.
I would just like to comment on one statistic that doesn't seem to match up with some of the numbers that we have at our section. And just to recap, I did testify at one of the previous hearings, but on our section, and we're part of the civil division of the Department of Law, we collect criminal restitution owed to victims, and we also collect restitution in juvenile delinquency cases that have gone to formal adjudication. And I did have a chance for my staff to look at some numbers, and we do have 356 open files on juvenile delinquency cases, and of that amount, we had over 124 that were over 5,000. So I'm not sure when Senator Guest had mentioned that 98% to 99% of cases are all under 5,000. I'm not sure if that's only in the civil context where the school district had, in the civil context, attempted to recoup money from juveniles and their parents through the civil process, as opposed to if there was some juvenile delinquency proceeding and whether the school district was trying to be made whole through the restitution process and the juvenile delinquency proceeding. But we do have over 124 cases that are over 5,000. I cannot tell you, of those 124, we do not always know what the damage was, if it's for personal injury or property damage, but we do have over 124 cases that are more than 5,000. So I just wanted to address that one statistic. And obviously, if any of the committee members have any other questions about you know, our process of collecting restitution for victims and how the current bill will make that process much, much slower and take much longer to collect money for victims, address any questions on that.
Okay, any questions?
And no, just in response, Senator Seekins, it is the case, and unfortunately we can't delineate between person and property crimes with the statistics, so we don't know. And I appreciate that clarity. The data that we got was dealing with school districts and municipality on actual damage, not when they necessarily found a victim or when they went or found a vandal. but kind of what their actual damage was on the number of cases. So it wasn't ones that had gone through the system.
Okay. So we do have one other person online that wanted to testify, Cynthia Hora. Cynthia, are you in line this morning?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
If you would introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you. My name is Cynthia Hora. I'm an associate victims' rights advocate with the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, and I'd like to comment some on the bill on behalf of victims. The Office of Victims' Rights supports the concept of consistency relating to the ability of crime victims to obtain restitution from those who have caused damage. The amount and ability to collect should not depend on whether the juvenile is placed on informal probation, adjudicated a delinquent formally, or sued civilly when the state decides not to prosecute. Restitution is very important to victims. They often pay a high emotional price, and they should not be required to bear the economic price of the crimes that have been perpetrated against them. Victims have to bear this financial loss out of pocket, up front, and they have to wait for the payment. The wait and delay has two stages. First, it can take months or a year or more before the juvenile case is resolved and restitution is formally ordered. Second, it can take months or years to collect the restitution once it is ordered. I'd like to just note that the citizens of Alaska recognize the importance of restitution to crime victims when it passed the constitutional right to restitution. The Office of OVR supports full restitution for victims and prompt payment, and we oppose any amendments that do not promote these goals. With respect to specific provisions, we oppose having the juvenile solely responsible for the first $5,000. And I've heard statistics over the course of these 2 days as to whether there's 98%, 66%, whatever percent of the juvenile cases may fall under the $500 threshold. To be honest, it really doesn't matter to victims. Victims should be the ones that are paid first. Having the juvenile solely responsible for the first $5,000 does not achieve that goal. We'd like parents to be liable. Parents are the ones then who can collect the juvenile's permanent fund dividends as they're paid annually or whatever, but as I say, the victims should be paid first. The office also opposes a cap on parental liability. Full restitution is essential to making the victim whole, and we don't believe that there should be any limitations on the parental liability, and therefore we oppose that cap. And this is particularly true if the parents are financially able to pay more than the proposed limit. Third, we oppose relieving parents of responsibility when the child's a runaway. We think this will just encourage parents to shirk their responsibilities and to call police every time their children leave without permission to avoid such responsibility. The purpose of the juvenile statutes dealing with delinquent minors addresses both juvenile and parental accountability, and we believe that holding parents fully liable will keep parents involved by making the juvenile work to pay the parents back and to get the restitution paid off. I'd like to direct the committee to the goals and purposes of the Chapter 12, which is the delinquent minor provision of Title 47. The purposes of this chapter, and I just want to read a few of them. It says, purposes of this chapter are to respond to a juvenile offender's needs in a manner that is consistent with, and one of those is restoration of the community and victim, to hold each juvenile offender directly accountable for the offender's conduct, to require parental or guardian participation in the juvenile justice process, to create an expectation that parents will be held responsible for the conduct and needs of their children, to ensure that victims, witnesses, parents, foster parents, guardians, juvenile offenders, and all other interested parties are treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, and sensitivity throughout all legal proceedings, and finally, to ensure that victims and witnesses of crimes committed by juveniles are afforded the same rights as victims and witnesses of crimes committed by adults. As I noted earlier, there is a constitutional right to restitution. Adults are ordered to pay the full amount of restitution, and there's no delay in payments if they can afford to pay up at the beginning as opposed to later on. Making parents and juveniles both liable for the restitution is the best tool to enforce this constitutional right and the purposes of the laws governing juvenile delinquency. And we'd ask that you not adopt the limitations for parental liability, that parents be liable for the whole amount, and that the provision dealing with the juvenile being responsible for the first $5,000 be deleted, and also that parents of runaways also be held liable. That's all I have.
Any questions? Ms. Hora?
Yes.
Any questions, Senator Gadd? No?
No, I would like to.
Thank you, Ms. Hora. We appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
If I could respond. Thank you. And I appreciate the testimony. And one thing I wanted to make clear is that in current statute, we don't require full restitution. This bill is actually the first attempt to actually conform all the systems so we actually could get to full restitution. That we have had cases where the damage has been $120,000, and the judge has looked at the juvenile and said, well, they can afford 10, and so that's what's been restitution. So I'm hoping this bill is moving towards actually getting to full restitution. I will not disagree with the previous testimony. It has been the practice of the legislature over the years and even within this bill to try to balance how much parents are liable, and it is solely a policy call. If restitution is our number one goal, and I think there's some arguments that it should be, then it should be parents are liable and there's no cap regardless of your insurance, and you know you're going to pay one way or the other as quickly as possible. And that's the policy call the legislature has to make. It's made different ones in the past. There's been some resistance to that approach, both because it doesn't hold the child at all accountable for their action, and it can put financial burdens on the family. But that doesn't mean it's not a legitimate policy action. I know the chair and I were talking to another one of our colleagues this last week, and that senator said, I think the kids should be liable for it all and the parents shouldn't be accountable. I mean, it is truly what this legislature thinks is important and how we balance those. And I don't think there's any situation that's invalid. It's just, what do we believe we want to do? I do believe it's important that we start having these three systems be consistent, that it shouldn't matter which system a juvenile goes through. It should have a similar outcome, and I do believe restitution needs, we need to start doing full restitution. Again, I tried in this bill to balance what we had done in the past and what I was hearing from folks, but again, in response to the Office of Victims' Rights, they are correct. If the number one goal is to get restitution back as quickly as possible, then the bill should be changed radically. For that purpose. It hasn't been my intent only because I was trying to balance other things, but that doesn't mean that it's not a valid policy call.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, there was one comment that was made in the last testimony that I do take some exception to, and I too believe in potential of full restitution, but obviously there are some difficulties with that. But the ability to pay is an interesting one to me, and we've become more and more prevalent in our society, and I think of it in some respects like this. I drive a 1995 pickup, got 210,000 or so miles on it. If I got stopped for going 75 miles an hour, and if you just took that pickup as a reflection of my income, I might pay $50. If Senator Guest was driving her BMW and got at the same speed, she might pay double that price. I'm not so sure that I buy into that sort of approach, because the crime's the same, the damage is the same, and just because we start this rationale of how we're going to collect more from one person than we are another. So it disturbs me to go down that path. I just put that on the record.
Thank you. Senator Huggins. Do we have anybody else that wants to testify on this bill?
That's it online, I believe.
Anyone in the audience? We're going to close public testimony on the bill at this time. And do we have any other further amendments to the bill? We want to talk about this. Do we want to, Senator French?
Mr. Chairman, as I look at this matrix or the table that Senator Guest so helpfully prepared, it strikes me that at the very least, the committee is in agreement that there should be some liability on behalf of the state when they assume custody of a child and the parental rights have been terminated. It strikes me that that's the most extreme case, and it's also the most narrow case. There are, from the testimony we've heard, 200 children in the state that fall into that category. So it would be my motion to adopt Amendment 0.2, which would hold the state liable where the state has custody and parental rights have been terminated.
And that's a motion by Senator French, and that would be amendment.
Not sure which number.
Number one
to this CS.
Number one to this CS. Okay, and I would, I lean more, I understand that. I think that's probably the one area that it comes out to. The state is liable when state has custody and parental rights are terminated. I lean more towards the 0.4, where they're liable for juveniles in their custody when the state has physical care responsibility for the juvenile. And the state is not liable for juveniles in their custody when the parents have physical care responsible for the juvenile. I lean more that way simply because I believe that it closes one more of the black holes as far as the property rights are concerned for the victim. I understand your argument. I have a different preference. Senator Guest.
Mr. Chair, it would be the case that if a child is in state's custody and physical care, that the parent, if the parental rights haven't been terminated, the parent still would be liable, so there wouldn't be a black hole as far as the victim's concerned.
Yes, I understand.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
I guess if the state comes and takes this child away from the parent, I have a hard time thinking that they can exercise any control over that child to be able to avoid that child being in a committing vandalism. That's where I guess probably my argument more centers. I believe that parents ought to have control of their children. I raised four teenagers. They're all past those ages. They've all become sane again, thank God. I'm now into being a grandparent, where grandchildren are God's reward for not having killed your kids when they were teenagers. So I'm at that point. But I will tell you that that is a concern, I think, of every parent as their children are going through those more tumultuous times in their life as to, do I know where my child is? Do I know what they are doing? And what level of control should I be able to exert on them? And in some respects, I have more propensity to be able to hold parents liable if, as long as we give them the authority in state law to be able to discipline their children, appropriately. Oh, we have an observer over here, over your shoulder there, Sen. Have you been feeding that seagull there, Senator French?
No, but I think someone in the room has.
Yeah. I guess I'm looking at that and saying, okay, if for some reason that the state has come in and removed that child from the authority and control of the parent, it's harder for me then to hold that parent responsible for the activities of that child when they can't exert any control over them. And that's kind of where I go. So I guess we could vote on this motion, or we could go off the record and discuss it a little bit longer. Are you ready to vote on the motion?
I think I'd rather go off record and discuss it.
Let's just go off record. We can have a little more of a freewheeling conversation. Let's go off the record. Back on the record.
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I would withdraw my motion to adopt Amendment O.2.
Thank you. The motion has been withdrawn without objection. Will the committee on additional amendments? Do we want to move it?
Yep.
Four. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, I move that O.4 be adopted as a new amendment.
Okay. O.4 has been, which is amendment number 2 to this bill, or this CS, and has been moved by Senator Huggins. Is there objection?
No objection.
Do you want to speak to the objections, Senator? There's one objection. Call the roll, please.
Senator Huggins?
Yes.
Senator Guest?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Chair Seacon?
Yes. O.4 has been adopted. At this time, the chair would request from the sponsor that the amendment be rolled into a new CS for the committee to consider on the following, on our next meeting, which would be Tuesday morning.
Yes.
With that, we'll carry this bill over and just take a short recess. We're back on the record. Next on our agenda is the CS for Senate Bill 209, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see multiple faces in the audience that, and I think I realized why we had that bird sitting. It was a veterans advocate that was there waiting to be heard. So that's how good the cause is. Mr. Chairman, what this bill represents is a rejuvenation, in my opinion, of a process that allows veterans organizations to do some good Samaritan, patriotic sort of duties to young people that are off in other places where parents aren't. And, of course, we put the face on that because we have my good friend Josh here, one of a few good men, he's a Marine Corps person, service member at this time, and, of course, we have some of the service organizations. But I'll let Josh take this forward. I think this is a good thing. Some people immediately say, well, this is about allowing people to come in and young people be able to come in and drink. It absolutely isn't that. The service organizations understand that this will require a greater diligence on their part, but it's the right thing to do. But, Josh, why don't you tell us why it's the right thing to do?
First, Colonel, I think his hair is getting a little long there, don't you?
Yeah, we're getting a little sidewalls there.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Josh.
For the record, my name is Josh Temple. I'm staff for Senator Huggins. I'll be presenting Senate Bill 209. Senate Bill 209 is an act relating to access by persons under 21 years of age to premises licensed to sell alcoholic beverages as clubs. Senate Bill 209 amends last statute 04.11.110 by authorizing access by persons under 21 years of age who possess a valid military active duty ID card or armed forces identification card issued by the United States Department of Defense or the United States Department of Homeland Security to a club's licensed premises without specific authorization of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board in certain circumstances. Under present law, persons under the age of 21 cannot be on the premises that are licensed to sell alcoholic beverages unless a parent or legal guardian accompanies them. Current law causes a dilemma to the underage veteran. Although they are eligible to join an organization, they are unable to go to the veterans' meetings or functions because they're underage. This legislation will in no way allow the consumption of alcoholic beverages by persons under the age of 21 in licensed clubs. This bill will simply allow our troops access to the supportive and safe environments which they currently are not allowed. A military organization post will truly be a place where veterans across the generations will have an accepting atmosphere in which they can impart their wisdom and stories. This bill will help ensure a place of safety for our troops while they're on the home front.
Questions for Josh. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh, my staff tried to find and was unsuccessful in trying finding the definition of patriotic organization in statute. Do you know if we, or Senator, do we know if we have one and what that definition is?
Through the chair, Senator Guest. It's understood that patriotic organization and veteran organization are one and the same. There is no definition spelled out in the statutes. But it is, there's no confusion as to it. Legal assured us of that.
Go ahead, Senator Gessa, or Senator Huggins.
If I may help Josh out with that. We dealt mainly with the American Legion on this, and there's a huge number of veteran service organizations. It's really veteran service organizations, but we tried to use the most inclusive term without ending up with a laundry list because, I mean, there's almost a Bible about yay thick when you start going through the different organizations that technically, but in the state of Alaska, we're really talking probably about 7 or 8 organizations, I recall. It'd be VFW, American Legion, DAV, a little bit, AMVETS, and help me out, who else it would be, that have posts.
VVA.
Yeah, I mean, it's in our case, in Alaska, it's less than 10, probably 6 or 7, that really have establishments where this would be involved.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Gass.
I guess my concern is not with the bill nor the purpose of the bill. I tend to have a handful of underage strip clubs right outside my district who are very creative with the law.
So if they put an American flag up there.
My concern is that patriotic organization isn't defined in statute, and someone says, I'm a patriotic organization. It wasn't the intent of the bill or the legislature, and then they decide that underage people can be in alcoholic establishments that aren't of the quality that we are talking about nor the purpose. And so I will put that back to you to figure it out, but it just worries me because I think your intent is, I agree with the intent, I think it's good and narrow, I think there are organizations that are responsible, but my worry is who's going to call themselves a patriotic organization so they can say, hey, servicemen, even if you're underage, you can come here even though there's alcohol served. And so
that's a point well made, and we can accommodate that, and I think that's wise counsel.
Just a little housekeeping, and then let me go to Senator French. Looks like we have a CS Yankee in front of us that we need to adopt.
Mr. Chair, I'll move CS for Senate Bill 209/Y version.
Is there objection? Hearing none. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank Senator Huggins for bringing us this bill. It seems like a really great idea, and I'm sure it's going to sail right through. My comment is kind of on along the lines of Senator Guess's. My first thought was Choku Charlie's running an American flag up the flagpole, but I don't see that as being a real issue. I don't think Choku Charlie's wants to have a bunch of people on the premises that can't consume alcohol. Their business model is not to, you know, sort of flood the place with people that are going to be a liability to them. Now, teenage strip clubs might be a different story. So I guess I would be comfortable giving the, director of the division of ABC the ability to define in regulation what a patriotic organization is, because I think they'll pretty quickly sniff out who the good guys are from who the bad guys are.
That's a good.
We can do it either way. I was going to suggest the same thing. We could either nail them down, or we could put.
We have Mr. Van Horn, and I know that this bill, I think, has gone a ways in the House. Is Jim? Would you come up and put yourself on the record?
Mr. Van Horn, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your comments this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is James Van Horn. I'm on the staff of Representative Jim Elkins. We've sponsored a mirrored bill in the House. It's House Bill 331. This did come up in our hearing. As for the purposes of a licensed club, as defined in the regulations by the ABC board, patriotic means veterans organizations. I'm not saying that the BPOE, the Elks, or the Moose are not patriotic organizations, but for purposes of licensing the private clubs, they're considered fraternal. But just for the purpose of licensing clubs, patriotic, in the terms of the statute, it means veterans clubs.
So that's already defined in regulation?
Yes, sir.
Good. Thank you. Other questions for either the gentleman? Senator Huggins?
If I might just add the other part of it, I got a call from the newspaper, and I think Jim talked to the newspaper guys once upon a time, and much like the panel here, after we discussed a little bit, there wasn't any skepticism about opening a wider gate for people, young people, to be able to drink, because I can assure you that if you go to Fort Richardson, there's a lot of alcohol that's available if you want to buy it, and there's wide open doors to be able to do that. And, you know, one of my concerns when I first talked to the American Legion people was that everyone understood that this would take mentally us narrowing the window of opportunity for young people, not anything that would just maintain status quo. So the important part to realize is that this gets young people in an environment that's healthy for them and their mission in life at that point in time, with older veterans sort of shepherding them. And the alternative is there are lots of places they can go and do things that the skeptics would think this bill might create. And I just use case in point. If we have a Veterans Day ceremony in November, and right after that, all these organizations open their doors, technically, young people that are in the military today can't go to that. And that's a sad commentary, but it's just a technicality, and this makes that permissible. And I, you know, Jim is one of the guys that's worked hard on these sorts of things. And of course, Josh personifies this. He's 22 now, but he was there once upon a time. And I just appreciate the support of the community and the open-mindedness that this is the right thing to do, and we're doing that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest.
If I could ask Jim a question. Have we talked to Jean Michelle? Have we talked to Ledge Legal? And are we sure that we don't need to put patriotic organization as defined in regulation in the statute?
Through the chair, Senator Guest. I just talked to Jean this morning, and she assured me that it was not a problem at all, as it was, that there's no conflict there as far as veterans organizations being patriotic organizations and patriotic being understood that it's a veterans organization.
Okay.
In other words, you were thinking of adding on line 12 under subparagraph 2 there, patriotic organization as defined in regulation.
In regulation, just to make it clear, if there is, from what I understand, there is a regulation now, correct, that defines patriotic organization. If legal says we don't need it, that's fine. It's just.
Why don't we ask Josh, of course, Jim, you can do the same on the House side, to just verify that everyone in the legal piece feels comfortable, and if we need to change it, we'll change it.
And you can do it in finance.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I recognize the point. I think it's very clear that the intent of this committee is that that definition is the definition as defined in regulation, which is a veterans organization.
Mr. Chairman, regulation. This says patriotic organization. It doesn't say that the patriotic organization is, in fact, a veterans organization.
No.
But it is understood that that's their definition for a private club license as a patriotic organization is veterans organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
So further questions on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I trust the sponsor will look into it. It's just any time where we say it's understood, it makes me worry, because it just provides a loophole for those people who want to take something that's not our intent. So.
And I don't think the sponsor is trying to.
No, and I know the sponsor is not trying to open that door.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have three people here that would like to testify. Clayton Love. Mr. Love, you'll come up, sir, and put your name on the record for us. We're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Clayton Love. I'm the commander for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Alaska. I just want to, I've been working with the VFW and American Legion on this also, and I just want to let everybody know that those clubs, those veterans clubs, as you want to put it, for example, VFW and American Legion, understand the reason for their license, their responsibilities. We're not advocating to lowering the drinking age or serving underage individuals at those clubs. It's more of a social type deal to where they can come in, like Senator Huggins put, as a friendly environment. They're out there dodging bullets with their buddies, but their buddies are 21 and older. They can come down to the VFW, shoot pool, no problem. They can't. the bartender will card them. That's the law. They're underage. So we're not advocating anything illegal. We'll just write up front. But it's just a friendly place for them to come in with other veterans, with the American Legion, the VFW. You don't have to be discharged from the military. You can still be active military and be a member. So we just want to clarify that we're not, it's not opening a can of worms. It's just for the younger veterans to be able to socialize with us older veterans and active duty. And then that ID card should be their sponsor. You know, because the government is sponsoring them in a sense with that ID card. And that's why I specified that's ID card. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, the bartenders know and the clubs know because that's their money for operating expenses, helping other individuals in the community and that type of deal. So we just want to make sure it's clarified, you know, that they will be treated just like if they walked into a bar down here. But at the same time, we'd like to have it like in a restaurant. They can walk in and order a cheeseburger, even though that restaurant sells alcohol. If they order a drink, they're going to be carded. But they can still come in and have that hamburger or hot dog. And I just would like to see that clarification there.
Questions for Mr. Love? Thank you very much, Mr. Love.
Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate
Mr.
it.
Thank you.
Is it John Wilkins? John, welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee.
Morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. If you'll put your name on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
I'm John Wilkins, Director of Services for the Department of Alaska Disabled American Veterans, and I'm here to give a little testimony on Senate Bill number 209. It's hard following Clayton. He said pretty much what's on everybody's mind. We would like to be treated in the veterans clubs or patriotic organization clubs as a restaurant. People go into a restaurant, if you're underage, you're carded if you ask for alcohol. And as Clayton said, and I'm going to say myself, we're not advocating changing the age of drinking in those clubs for anyone. Personally, I'm a non-drinker myself, but other people do, and that's their right if they're over 21. All we want is to be, treated fairly, the same as a restaurant. The young people, men and women, that come back need mentoring, they need the camaraderie, and we can supply that. We've been there, we've done it, can help a lot of young people. And I would appreciate it if our legislature here would pass this bill and give us the opportunity to prove to you that what we're asking for is not to serve alcohol to underage people, but to allow them to come into our clubs for our veteran activities.
Okay.
That's about all I can say.
Questions for Mr. Wilkins? Thank you very much, sir, for being here with us. So, Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, before John leaves, I'd just like to toot his horn for a moment. And, you know, he's a member of the DAV and a number of organizations, and I think most of us recognize that there's a core group of people in veterans organizations that sort of carry the guide on the military term for veterans and really want to do the right thing. But John had an interesting function. Let's call it the veterans boat. And what technically, what do you call it? What's the...
We call it the vet boat.
The vet boat. And it's down here. And would you just describe to us real quick your role in that?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the vet boat is an organization we started in 1998, I believe it was. My wife Connie and I came to Alaska. And being a disabled veteran, I, of course, looked up the local disabled veteran outfit here, joined. And at my first meeting, I found out that in Southeast Alaska, there are no roads. I didn't know anything about Alaska when I first came up. And they were talking about they didn't have a way to reach the veterans in Southeast Alaska. It's too expensive to fly. The stump jumpers or the float planes, way too expensive. A lot of people's disabilities keep them out of them. And the ferry system, the timing just really... makes it rough to go down and check on the veterans. So wife and I went home, we sit down, we talked about it, said, well, let's buy a boat so we can go and check on these veterans. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the rest is history. We've been running the southeast with that old boat and checking on veterans, and everywhere it is, Prince of Wales, Una, Angoon, Cake, we go. And it's mostly sponsored by my wife and myself. We get a few donations from different organizations and different people, but 80% of it is sponsored by my wife and myself, but it's something we want to do. Being a retired first sergeant, you never retire. You're just a first sergeant that goes from one outfit to go to the other one. So I'm in a civilian outfit now, but I still got my troops out here that need help. And that's what we do.
God bless you, sir. And your wife, Connie.
Thank you, sir. And anytime anyone would like to take a trip with us, I'm more than glad to take you along.
All right. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, there's always a downside when I see John Wilkins. I realize that though I haven't lost the hair he has, I have the same gray hair and the wrinkles he does, because some of us veterans are getting a bit older. But, John, we appreciate everything you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, John.
Charlie.
Mr. Colbert, Howard Colbert. Mr. Colbert, welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee this morning.
Thank you.
And, sir, if you'll put your name on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony as well.
My name's Howard Colbert. I'm a commander of Juneau's DAV Chapter 4. I like to have just kind of like a little different spin on Senate Bill 209. I am in favor for it. A little background. You have to excuse me because I'm just a little nervous. A little background on the DAV is it was set up by Congress. And because it was set up by Congress, there's no drinking in this. You cannot have your meetings where there's a place where you drink. And that's good. That's really good. But because we have a dollar budget, when we spend it, we have to get change back. And we really don't have a post. So we meet at the library when it's convenient for the library. A lot of times it's not really convenient. So we just kind of where we can meet. The federal government, you know, when they're handing rifles to kids that are 17, 18, 19 years old, you know, there's problems. And there's always going to be problems. There has been problems. I myself spent 2 tours in Vietnam. I know the problems because I was just a young kid and shouldn't have seen what I saw. Because veterans are such a small portion of the population, you know, you get a lot of flack and there's a lot of problems. But because you were a trooper, there's this camaraderie that you find no place else in the world, no place else. And it's troopers helping troopers. Well, the DAV, like I said, doesn't really have a place to meet. So we have to go to these benevolent organizations like the American Legion and the VFW. Well, these are businesses. Basically, they're businesses. They sell alcohol. So because we have young troops, and we have to be able to meet someplace. So they let us come into their buildings and what have you, and allow us to talk to the troops, to be able to do our paperwork with these guys, and be able to go through the process. It seems like our government is built on paperwork. And if you don't know the paperwork, then you can't get the services that these people are guaranteed. So you really can't go into a guy's home and say, well, you can't serve alcohol. And as long as the government is having guys with 17, 18, 19 year olds with problems, you know, you have to have a place to meet. And they also deserve the services. Let's see, I had a lot of good things.
Oh, you're doing a great job.
So anyway, you know, the VFW and the American Legion are like libraries. They really are. There's such a wealth of knowledge in these things of combat veterans that, you know, they know a lot. They can speak to the younger troops. And if you haven't realized this yet, you're going to have a lot more younger troops that you're going to have to deal with in the next 10 years. Because what's going on overseas is not your traditional. It's not your jungle. It's kind of a whole new scenario. And these guys, these young guys, are going to have problems. And the DAV will always be there for them. The American Legion will always be there for them. The VFW will always be there for them. It's just allowing us to go into these places to be able to deal with these guys. And, you know, on the drinking thing, these guys kind of police their own place. We can't very well tell them how to live when we go into their hospitality rooms or whatever. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. I have a lot more things to say, but, you know, I'm just kind of over my head. And I hope you have some questions.
Howard, you're doing a great job. Questions for Mr. Colbert?
I just want to say thank you very much for showing up today and testifying on behalf of the bill. You did a fine job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Howard. Anybody else? Thank you very much, Mr. Colbert, for being here today. Anyone else that wants to testify on this bill online? Anyone else in the audience? Close public testimony. Discussion? Senator Guest.
Mr. Chair, I'll move CS for a Senate Bill 209 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved from committee to its next committee of referral. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? Seeing none, it's now 21 minutes after the hour of 10 a.m., and this committee is adjourned until next Tuesday.